but the inevitable death is what we want to talk about.
Listen up, Umi. This is a podcast with the most Tucker. This is Forge the Narrative.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Forge the Narrative. My name is Paul, your host, We All About All Souls Podcast. I'm joined by Tanya Gates.
Hey, everybody.
And Adam Camilleri.
Howdy.
Hello, everyone. Red will be back next week. Look, it's been an exciting week of Warhammer 40,000. Had the WGC event last weekend. Adam, you were there?
Yeah, man. Was I ever.
Talking about Warhammer. You know, that's what we do around here. And in our spare
time.
Turns out. I got to play some Warhammer 40K. I was not at the WGC, but I got to play in my my home environment, which is really nice. I played a Astra Militarum list, kind of heavy on the indirect fire, which I really liked, by the way. And also the Demolisher Cannon. I'm in love with the Demolisher Cannon.
The one on the Lehman Russ, or yes. The one on the Baneblade, or the
Well, I mean, you know, pick your, you know, choose your I guess delivery mechanism, your chassis
yeah. choice.
Yeah. But no, I think it has a great profile, matches up really well against a lot of things out there you see right now, like Wraith Guard.
Yeah,
you know,
I agree with that. Yep.
To where, I mean, I considered taking as many as possible. I'm talking about like a couple of tank commanders, you know, and then several Lehmans. You eat up a lot of points that way. And that I don't know is the best right now, but really enjoyed the indirect fire profiles, especially when you can support it with things like the Hellhound to flush people out, which is the actual rule, but basically remove their benefit of cover, and then doing spotters from Sentinels and stuff.
Yeah, I really am a fan of the Hellhounds, and Hellhounds are like my favorite unit in all of 40K. So them having them having a good bit of utility and reason to be taken is joyous.
Got a little OC, got a little, you know, auto hitting, which is nice.
The only thing that would make them like perfectly fluffy for me is if they like automatically blew up.
Yeah, always. But that has been shown to be problematic in the past.
I know. It's just like in the lore, they put like the hotheads in there, you know? I could just see them doing it.
Well, I'd really enjoyed using them as far as that went. And I was using the Kim Cannon on there, which is 12-inch anti-infantry 2+, D6 plus 1, strength 2. So, you know, depending on what you're shooting at, that could be a problem. If you're shooting at anything that's not infantry, then AP2, 2 damage apiece. So, you know, pretty good. I'm not in love with the 12-inch range, but I got over it.
Yep.
And then the ability on that there is the flush them out, like I was talking about. In your shooting phase, after this model has shot, select one enemy unit that was hit by one or more of those attacks. Until the end of the phase, that unit cannot have the benefit of cover. And I would like to point out that that is not just for the cannon or whatever. It could also be a heavy bolter you put on the front.
Because all you need to do is it just hit and you get the activation.
Yeah, what causes the ability to trigger? Attacks. Yeah, that was hit.
Yeah, and is it only one unit that it gets hit?
Yep.
Or is
yep.
it? Yeah.
Oh, sorry. Sorry. Select one. Yeah, it is. Select one enemy unit that was hit by one or more of those attacks. Yeah.
So that's really cool. So you put the heavy bolter on and you can select something 36 inches away while you roast and toast something on an objective right next to you.
Yes. And that was also very fun to do. and then the spotting that we're talking about from the Sentinels is the daring recon. At the start of your shooting phase, select one enemy unit within 18 inches of and visible to this unit until the end of the phase. Each time a friendly Astra Militarum model makes an attack that targets that unit, reroll a hit roll of a 1. If that attack has the indirect fire ability, it does not suffer the penalty to hit roll for shooting at the target that is not visible to the attacking unit. So they got two benefits there. There's the indirect part, and then just the reroll hit rolls at 1, which also really enjoyed using. Because each time a friendly Astra Militarum model makes an attack that targets that unit. It doesn't say you pick a specific unit. It is any old body. So if you didn't think Scout Sentinels had enough utility being OC2, movement of 10, then, you know, here's a bonus. You can also stick a las cannon and a chainsaw on it. There's legs in the Astra Militarum. We have not seen them really kind of dominating the scene, but I also think it's one of those indexes that just has, you know, a plethora of units
yeah.
that you can choose.
It's got a lot of depth and a lot. And I mean, we don't talk Forge World much on this show these days. I think Forge World has dropped off, but the Ashamil Time, like, you know, portion of Forge World is still pretty healthy compared to a lot of other factions. So there's definitely some options there for some of the other spicy takes, but man, like you're right. It's really deep. It's a really deep book, especially now that you've got like things like Sentinels have been made from, well, I started collecting Guardian late 6th edition, and Sentinels were just, there was no reason to buy Sentinels in all of 6th, all of 7th, and pretty much all of 8th edition. But they've really turned a corner now, and they're a very, very strong unit.
They used to come in a 3-pack of Catechin
yes.
Sentinels or whatever,
yep.
and so
yep.
happened to have a bunch sitting around ready to go. And I've had mine fitted with Last Cannons for a long time. I mean, but granted, that is pre-4th edition Last Cannon Sentinels. No, but it's been fun. It was fun to play. Enjoyed, you know, getting some of the Guard Squads on the table. You actually use some Chimeras. I like the all mech'd up version of it. Of course, had a couple of Tempestus Scion units to beam in.
Yep.
Now, the weapon loadouts on them have changed a bit. You can't have double of the same special weapon anymore, really, mm-hmm. in a 5-man squad. Mm-hmm. So that did require some weapon swaps.
It's so funny. This sounds exactly like how I was playing at like the beginning of 9th edition. Like, this could be my old army list.
Just
this
wheel it
crazy.
Out.
Yeah. I'm like looking at my shelf and it's just all of the units that you just mentioned plus Bulgrin.
Mm-hmm. I haven't
That's
seen
accurate.
Bulgrin
no, I haven't
really
either.
Take the field. But at the same time, let's talk about the sheer volume of units again in this index. Is that, well, let's state the glaring obvious. It's not Eldari.
Who is?
Yes.
Where every unit is basically a rock star. You know, you can kind of just, you know, go to, which is nice. As an Eldari collector and player, I really like the idea of knowing that I can go and pick out, you know, any unit that I have painted on my shelf and play it. And I feel like it's going to do reasonably well.
Exactly right. It's a beautiful place to be for the Eldari players. Eldari privilege is alive and well. I don't think there's any denying. Yeah, any denying. Because literally you could just use a dartboard to decide your list, and it's probably still better than the vast majority of best possible lists for other factions. It's just so strong at the moment. I have concept Eldari lists that I'm just waiting to see when they arrive, because they're still phenomenally good, but there's just no reason to play that list like yet, when you've got, you know, Wraith Guard, Fire Prisms, Night Spinners, Wraith Knights, the Yinkarn. So I had to commentate on games at WTC where it was Eldar versus Eldar. And the sheer amount of time the players had to take away from directly playing the game to try and figure out whose Yinkarn got to pop up where and how and why, and then the dichotomy of do I do it, and then you do it, and then you charge me, but then I charge you, and I heroic intervention, and I was just like, can we just delete the Yinkarn? Just let's just move on with our lives.
The Yinkarn is phenomenal. Like that.
It is.
That
it
model.
Might,
yeah, can do a lot.
It might be the best single model in the game. It might be the best single model.
Let's talk about what it can do and the implications of what it can do in part two of the show.
Sure.
Because I think that's worth unpacking, because that's one of those things that could be a real gotcha for players. Yep. And in knowing, one, how much damage it puts out, how much damage it can take, and then what kind of triggers it to jump across the table, be everywhere, seemingly everywhere on the table, basically be a menace, might be worth unpacking in part two. But I just don't want to distract too much far away, you know, away from the kind of the Astra Militarum talk here, because there are some real cool things in that codex, but some of them are just kind of, you know, models and t-shirts and stuff, and you've got to real be strategic with how you apply them if you want to go that route, or go with the indirect fire and then figure out ways to support that indirect fire. But the type of terrain that you play with and you have makes a big difference.
Absolutely. I mean, of course, there's the G-Dub prescribed terrain, what G-Dub thinks is the best use, which I also think is working very well on the vast majority of tables. I think they've done a good job.
You're talking about like the US Open Series terrain format of certain patterns and creating specific lanes of fire, certain ratios of 2 and 4 inch and higher terrain.
Yeah. And also the plates, like, I guess like the plexiglass.
Yep.
Squares and stuff on table. Having a footprint for your terrain really takes away quite a bit of ambiguity at times when interacting with the 10th edition rules.
Yes.
Like, am I in terrain? Well, are you on the thing? Yes or no? There's no, like, how much of you is obscured? It's just like, can I see all of you, and are you on the thing? And if you're on the thing and I can't see all of you, you're in cover.
I do like that. That kind of pass fail.
Yep. It makes it pretty straight up and down.
Playing with good terrain is just absolutely mandatory to have a balanced experience with the game right now. But I shouldn't say that right now. Right now sounds like it's a qualifier. It's actually been that way for a long time. But I think it's especially important right now.
Absolutely.
And so even if you don't have maybe the best terrain for your home games, I think it's time, you know, you it's perfectly reasonable to have conversations with your opponents about what effect you want from the terrain, and maybe be considerate's not really what I'm going for. When you, like, you overly indulge in the gracious with the definition and footprint of the terrain to create a good play experience with your opponents. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's just very necessary with the way they've designed their game also. Like, it's the lethality hasn't reduced as much as I guess maybe some people wanted, or, you know, G-Dub designed the game as they designed it. But the lethality of 9th edition, where we left off with 9th edition, was absurd. And whilst a fair few things have pared down, it's still, you know, in the reign of if I see you, you are dead. So terrain is the absolute third player now, undeniable third player. Then you might even say the fourth player is the deck of cards, where you're just like ripping off the top. That's actually funny. Proliferate that, everybody.
There we go. The fourth player is the cards. And you also talk about jumping around to, you know, talk about indirect fire, and, you know, we mentioned that we had not talked about Forge World a lot. One of the Astra Militarum Forge World units that is becoming somewhat standard is the Earthshaker carriage.
That's correct. And I suppose it's not that we haven't really we haven't had a reason to talk about Forge World for a while. Forge World really goes through through a cycle of being relevant and not relevant to the game. And whilst, you know, there are evergreen Forge World units, and there's some of the most excellent models you could ever own, they're not always relevant to some factions. Like, I mean, Custodes Forge World is always a thing of relevance, because there are several units available to the Custodes faction in Forge World that they can't really get elsewhere, like the Caladius Grav Tank, which essentially is their mainline battle tank. The Land Raider, you know, whilst awesome and probably the best it's been in, you know, almost a decade, still isn't a Caladius, and the Caladius offers a lot for the army that you can't do without.
The Sagittariums look so cool.
Yeah, and the Venatari, like jump infantry. There are things that you can't get anywhere else. But there are factions where they just have everything that they need already. Like Space Marines, a lot of the time, anything you could find in Forge World, it has a contemporary in the vanilla book. I mean, it can be said, when you have 100 freaking data sheets, there's not many wild, spicy things they can hide in the Forge World side. But there are times when the Forge World section has been really good, some times otherwise. I mean, the same goes for Guard. Until we got the Dawn, if you wanted a tank that was between a Russ and a Baneblade, you had to go to Forge World. It was either the Malkador or the Macarius. But now the Dawn sits in that realm itself, and the model is, whilst I do, my personal favorite is the Macarius Vulcan. Thank you very much. My favorite tank of all time. The Dawn looks pretty good.
The Macarius is the one that's kind of slow in 40K. Is that the one? But I think in 30K, it's actually very fast. There's like over the last 2,000 years, the engines through a rod or something.
So I don't think the Macarius wasn't around in 30K. I think you called the Malkador was the one around.
Malkador, that's what I'm. Yes.
Yeah. If you ever wanted to know, you just think about when the name was. So Malkador existed in 30K. Macarius wasn't around yet. Macarius was like thousands of years after the Heresy. And he got his name there. So then they wouldn't have had anything to name the tank after.
Fair enough. Talking about this Earthshaker here. D6 plus 3 shots, hits on a 5+, strength 8, yep. make 2 damage. Here's the ability here, is the Earthshaker rounds in your shooting phase after this model has shot. If one or more of those attacks made with this Earthshaker cannon scored a hit against an infantry unit until the end of your opponent's next turn, that infantry unit is shaken. While the unit is shaken, subtract 2 from its movement characteristics and subtract 2 from its advance and charge rolls.
Yeah, I find I've always had a bit of a worry that these style of things can be a little bit oppressive.
I've played against this, and it was really difficult. I mean, granted, my list is kind of slow for orcs, but it was really hard to work around that. And you know, I feel like if it was, you know, subtract 2 from your move or charge or advance, you know, like it might be a little bit better. But like just having it off of everything, it's like, oh, okay, this is my life now.
My issue is there are some armies that only have like a handful of like premium units. I'm actually talking about custodies again. We're seeing a lot of infantry heavy custodies lists, and then they play against a triple earth shaker list or night spinner or thunderfire, and you're like, well, your whole army moves 3 inches and is -2 to advance and charge. It just there's a little bit. I was always of the opinion that I think the thunderfire is the best example of this. It's got a crap profile. And by crap, I mean it's not a profile that kills things judiciously, but has a premium buff or a premium debuff. And when I look at units that have both, and the Earthshaker is a great example of that, but the Night Spirit is another great example of things that have both. You can either have a great buff or debuff, but you don't get to be a killing machine, or you can have a killing machine, and you don't get a great buff or debuff. And the Earthshaker is one that does both, which is why it stands out and why I think it's got your attention, Paul, because it's a really good unit.
Yeah. 80 points.
Yeah.
Not too bad. Then jumping over, talking about the Lehman Russ, we're talking about how, you know, really liked some of the cannons and stuff on that. Sorry, I was speaking specifically about the tank commander, because I think that was a little bit better for maybe what I was using it for in this particular list. But you can certainly sub it out for, you know, the non-HQ slot is the Demolisher Battle Cannon, 24-inch range, D6 plus 3 shots, strength 14, neg 3 AP, and D6 damage blast.
That's a good profile.
Not to like. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Where's the issues? That's phenomenal.
Tank commander has the ability to issue orders, which is also nice. Mm-hmm. And then the death benefiting an officer is an ability here, is that when this model is destroyed, roll a D6 on a 2+. Do not remove it from play. It can, after the attacking model's unit has finished making its attacks, shoot as if it were your shooting phase and as if it had full wounds remaining. The model is then removed from play.
Oof.
Spicy.
I like that. I did get to use that as well. So it's kind of bittersweet, but at the same time, you know, when you've got weapons like that, you know, getting another opportunity to shoot them while getting also the benefits of the tank, you know, throughout the other rounds, it's pretty good. I enjoyed using it. It was fun. Mm-hmm. I had to actually roll my hits though, so, you know, I'm obviously at a disadvantage against players.
You have to roll dice.
You stack things up. Plus one to hit, rerolling ones. You know, there's things you can do. Yeah.
That's some weak sauce Mon Kai stuff right there.
Yeah, having to roll dice sometimes is a chore. But there's hope out there. There are things you can do, and actually, once you identify what the menace is, you can start to look into your index and hopefully find some answers to it. You know, as a for instance, Chaos Knights. You know, if one big old target or two big old targets is easy for your opponent to vaporize, give them 13 medium size targets, all with a giant OC attached to them.
Yep, nothing wrong with that.
Start playing a different game on them, and you've got some hope. You make it a game. Is where I'm going. I don't even know if this is y'all's experience that you're seeing out there.
For me, I am generally not great at the game. So at my event, I didn't have to face any of like the big bad factions. Oh, that's not true. I faced Custodes. But yeah, I haven't had the absolute pleasure of playing into Eldar yet.
Well, you're in for a treat.
Oh, I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, I do think there. So a lot of the things we learned about playing the game in 9th edition are really still hold true in 10th edition. I'm starting to see a lot more people build for fixed objectives as well. And not saying they always take fixed objectives in the mission choice, but they want the option to. And a lot of the time, it's like just about everybody I know of building to take like deploy, teleport, homers, or is it scramblers? I can't remember which one of them. The one where you get 3 points in the middle or 4 or 5 points in your opponent's deployment zone when you do an action. Well, not when you do an action. You know, when you choose not to shoot or charge, essentially, yep. which is what we call actions now, pretty much. And a lot of people choosing to do those and or, you know, that plus assassinate, that plus bring it down, that plus behind enemy lines, that plus, you know, something else. But then they don't always pick it. They're just wanting the diversity of options. Because what we're finding is that, let's say you're playing a faction that can't beat Eldar. Well, what's the game you can play where you get the best score versus Eldar? Because that's the next best thing you can do. And then you can start working to that. Once you've got that under your belt, you can start working from there to try and close the gap even further. And a lot of the time, you know, just not getting tabled can be the best thing you can do. So picking two stable secondaries that don't involve you having to be like, well, I need to go and get two units deaded to do this, you know, hold objective or whatever. Doing things that don't require you to 100% lose models, lose units, is a great second step. The other one
Let's talk about that for just one second, if you don't mind, is that when you say 100% lose models, sometimes like go over there and control the enemy objective, you know, you're putting yourself in harm's way, tempting target, come out here where I can get you kind of thing.
Yeah, and they're not always things you're going to guarantee have tools for when you draw them, whereas if you just build to do the fixed secondaries, no matter what, you'll always have a decent fallback. I mean, pulling two cards and not scoring any is worse than doing teleport homers once for 3 points, you know? And so either way, like you can iron out your variance just a little bit more. The other way to play it is to not focus on the freaking cards at all and to just play the primary. Just double and triple down on playing primary, which is exactly what you were alluding to. This is why we're seeing custodians be so powerful. Things like Necrons as well, because Necrons can wield like super amounts of OC on ultra durable, what we would have called bully units in the past. Units that bully the table are imposing. And we're starting to see more and more of these bully units pop up. Like, I mean, Aberrance is now the best, is a much better option for GSC lists than Adeline Jackals, thanks to the recent FAQ by G-Dub. Great job there, G-Dub. It was a perfectly adequate change. You know, we're seeing Wraith Guard, we're seeing Lich Guard, we're seeing Custody Guard, we're seeing so many of these imposing, you know, aggressive units, but they're unlike previous editions where we would buff those things up to the stratosphere and then send them at our opponent. Their job is to hold the objectives and be so imposing that you're not going to try and stop them. And that is an absolute play that many different armies can do. And then I've also seen, now this is freaking wild, yeah. When I first read Battleshock, I was like, that's not going to be a thing. I looked at it, I'm like, ah, they did it again. Another morale phase that isn't that big a deal. But I digress. I have seen some very good players wield it judiciously to harm their opponents.
And do you mean the factions that they kind of play in that space a little bit?
Yeah, exactly right. Well, I've seen Chaos Knights being the biggest one I've seen wield it. Where I looked at their rules when I did their initial review and reading, I'm like, pretty sure 80% of this is never going to come up. I mean, when it does, I'll be happy. But unlike other special rules that are just there all the time, this one, you know, it's got some T's and C's on it. I'm pretty sure it's just not going to be a thing. And then someone's got like 10 Lich Guard on an objective and they fail their battle shock. And you're like, well, here's like one little dinky model and I might just win the game. I actually had that happen in one of the singles at the singles games at the WTC. There was a player who was playing Demons. And they use their once per game, like everybody take a battle shock test. And this guy had three units on an objective, all three failed battle shock, and the guy walked on like one demonette, took the objective, had the bottom of turn, scored the primary, because it was the bottom of turn five, scored the primary. You know, I can't remember if he won the game off that, but it was a story that came from there.
Yeah.
And everyone was just like, no. No, that did not happen. I'm like, he's like, yeah, it happened, man. Absolutely bizarre. So
I think this is going back, you know, to just the core principle of, you know, looking at what tools do you have to solve what your problem is instead of just wishing the problem wasn't there.
Wasn't there. Exactly right. Because, I mean, the problem is probably, you know, we've seen the game change a lot over time and it's going to evolve. There is no way that the problems we have now are going to be the problems we have in 6-9 months from now.
Yeah, so if you put a mechanism in place of how you attack the whatever the situation is, then you'll be more successful than trying to ignore it. Yeah.
The more of the, well, I don't want to say head in the sand because there are a lot of people who are very loud and it's very, very, I wouldn't be able to hear you as much if you had your head in the sand. This isn't disparaging. This is the hallmark of a passionate community more than anything else.
Yeah.
I
also want to say that when it feels like your opponent is not playing a dice game, when you are playing a dice game, it, you know, it can leave some feels.
Mm.
So, you know, the passion is probably coming from a place that, you know, that is at least reflective of some experience that was had.
Yeah, exactly right. And much better to be proactive and learn something about the game and maybe better yourself as a player against a juggernaut faction than to just wish it wasn't there, wish it would go away. I think this is just a philosophy of life. Like, you know, You can apply that, what I just said, to many different things.
And I'm not saying there's an answer in every single body's indexes or eventual codexes or whatever. I'm just saying that, you know, be open to looking for those things. And that is how you win more games more often, even in the face of, you know, stouter players or stouter list or whatever. So that's and I've had some success with this. Had some games that I've felt pretty good about in the last few weeks or so. With,
real happy to hear, man.
With that mentality.
Yeah.
You know, I still might take Eldar to the next tournament, you know, but...
I'm bringing my meme list, baby.
There you go. I'm really enjoying the Astra Militarum. You know, one, because I like playing with tanks, and it's a faction that's not getting a lot of attention or love right now. So I've kind of enjoyed cracking it open. I enjoy the mechanized version of things, even though, you know, I like playing horde armies too. But I there's something about just all those tanks on the tabletop that I like seeing sometimes.
Yeah.
So here we go. Let's take a quick break, and as promised, we'll come back and talk about the menace of the Incarn. It's like a story. Anyway, hold tight, everybody.
FTN is brought to you by Discount Games, Inc. Please visit them at www.discountgamesinc.com. And don't forget to ask Jay about ways to save even more on your hobby projects.
Hey, everybody, welcome back. Thank you very much to our Patreon subscribers. Help us all the behind-the-scenes stuff of the show. I really appreciate y'all doing that each and every month. If you'd like to join in on that, please see the link in the show notes. You know, any tier is an awesome tier. It helps keep the show going. Helps us do, you know, many things to bring you this content. And we really appreciate y'all doing it. Thank you very much to everyone that has done it or considered doing it. It means a whole lot. We promised we would talk about the Incarn. The Incarn is one of those... Ennead? That's the way I pronounce it? Ennead is came from the Unari faction back in the, what is it, the Psychic Awakening? Is that when we first got those models on the the scene?
Yeah, got the Triumvirate.
Yep, with Yvrain, the...
Vizark.
Yep. And then the Incarn, which is the avatar of Ennead.
I did love all the memes that came out, like you know, like the Dark Knight memes, not the avatar we deserve, is the avatar you need. The crowd goes mild.
No.
Yeah. Anyway, this model has one of the most unique and flavorful rules that any model has ever been given in the history of our game.
Let me run down the base stats here. So it's 270 point model for one thing. Movement of 10, toughness of 10, 2 plus save, 12 wounds, leadership of 6, and an OC of 3 with a 4 plus invulnerable save. And that's only barely scratching the surface, but I at least wanted to set, you know, what its base stats are.
Yep.
Has a bit of a range weapon, kind of a 12-inch flamer type weapon, ignores cover and torrent, is also a psychic attack, D3 plus 3 shots, strength 7, neg 1 AP, D3 damage, so, you know, pretty good, and then has a melee weapon, which has two different profiles, has a strike and a sweep. It can get up to strength 12 on the strike, D6 plus 1 damage, 10 attacks with the sweep, strength 6, neg 4, 1 damage. And then we start getting into the real spicy stuff.
Yeah, it's got half damage.
So that's the deathly form. Each time an attack is allocated to this model, half the damage characteristic of that attack.
Extremely good. And here's the spice. Here's the headache maker. Inevitable death. Once per phase, if this model is on the battlefield when another unit is destroyed, just after removing the last model in that unit, you can remove this model from the battlefield and set it up again as close as possible to where that destroyed model was and not within engagement range of any enemy model. So this guy teleports to wherever the last model removed from a dying squad was. So means it's very important to ask your opponent which is the last model they're removing, but that you have an absolute unlocked table of absurdity at times in which to just play whatever games you want.
This is a staple in a lot of Eldari lists. This is not something that has to be just Yanari, because Yanari is now unlocked by Yvrain. Yvrain is the psychic character that comes with the Grinxis. I think it's what it is. The old Eldar cat model.
The spirit cat.
Yeah, she comes with that, and she is the model that unlocks the Yanari faction that allows you to bring in other Asarani units like Drukhari and that kind of stuff. This is not what's happening here. You as an Eldari player, you can just take the Incarn in your list, and that is your only. Well, there is no tax. you just do this.
Yeah.
Which means being an Eldar unit also gets access to the Strands of Fate, which is the thing that allows Eldar to just substitute dice that they've previously rolled into things for.
Cheat. You mean cheat. Yeah. Absolutely.
Reference the, you know, when you're playing, you feel like your opponent's not playing a dice game. This is one contributor to that with this Strands of Fate. But the inevitable death is what we wanted to talk about, because this thing, it can just pop up in the middle of your army when you were not necessarily expecting it, unless you expect it. But then, if you are expecting it, is there anything you can do about it?
So, there is some things you can do. So what you do not want to have happen is for... And so this is... We've already said it. Was it once per phase? It was one per phase, yeah?
Once per phase with the inevitable death, yes.
Yeah, yeah. Really wish it was once per turn, or even once per battle round, or once per game, once per calendar year. This would all be great options.
One time that you can do that against an opponent somewhere that already happened.
Yeah, and they get to punch like a key card, you need card, and once you've spawned the avatar so many times, you get to do it again. Like you spawn the avatar, you know, three times in, you know, across 3 months, you get a fourth one. But never mind. This is really psychologically potent, regardless of the fact that this is actually a very good unit. Essentially, is a greater demon-esque profile, both in combat and defensively. You can really cause some headaches for your opponent. So let's say I've got a couple of Night Spinners, or I've got a Wraith Knight or whatever. I kill something on the flank of your army. I spawn the Yinkan. In your turn, if you can't see it, can't shoot it, can't connect with it, you can't move that way. If that was is killing something on an objective, guess what? That objective is now mine. Let's say you made ingress towards it. You move towards it with one of your best units to try and contend that and take the objective back, but you need to charge the Yinkan to get on the objective. In the shooting phase of the opponent to the Yinkan shoots and kills maybe, let's say, five Rangers on the other side of the board. The Yinkan leaves that objective, goes to where the Rangers were, and now your best unit can no longer charge on the objective. There is so many ways this can mess with your opponent's plans, but there are things you can do to stop the Yinkan from being problematic. One of the biggest things you can do is spread out your unit. Because it spawns off the last model, if you have a unit where, you know, if the Yinkan spawns to the closest model, it'll have an easy charge into something you don't want it to get to, but you're going to get killed by Night Spinners or a D Cannon or something from out of line of sight. Spread your unit out so the last one you remove is like a 10, 11, 12-inch unchargeable thing to for the Yinkan to spawn there and chain into your army in their turn. So you can really limit its aggressive impact, I guess.
I have to make one correction to something you said during that.
Just one.
Yeah, that's okay.
Red's not here, so I guess you can only do what you can do.
It is not kind of like a demon. It is a demon. actually, fair. It is a demon.
Yeah.
But everything else you said is exactly correct. So when I think what you're saying is to kind of be cognizant of the fact that this thing can do that, which is kind of what we're doing as a little PSA here, is that when this is on the field, when your opponent has it on the field and they are looking to target a unit and the Incarn has not jumped yet, and most likely that is why they are targeting that unit, is to jump the Incarn. And so if you have any hand in how you are removing your models as casualties, you want to think about that, if that's still an option for them to utilize during that turn.
It's also a big thing to know and understand what is in your best interest, how you stagger your offense, especially your shooting offense. If you're an army that doesn't have great profiles at killing the Yinkan, you need to know when you need to know when to pull the trigger.
That toughness like 10 is a problem.
It really is, man. Toughness 10, half damage, 4-up invuln is actually a big problem for some people, for some armies. There are some whole armies out there that can't kill this guy in a phase. They can't one-shot this thing. So, and especially...
When you say one-shot, yeah, you mean one phase. Like most of their army fires at it.
Yeah, exactly right. Your whole army won't kill it because of the half damage, because maybe you've got all damage 2 profiles or whatnot, or it just spikes the 4-ups or etc. Or you've got lots of Melter and Plasma, and you haven't put Oath of Moment on it if you're a Space Marine. This is something I've seen as well. Space Marine armies at times, and this is actually a good thing you can do, so much the better if you take Gilliman and you've got 2 Oaths of Moment, but you just keep Oath of Moment on the Incarn all game. All game. Doesn't matter. And so you're, the price of you being like, no Yin Khan, is that if they ever beam it over to you and they, then they try and move it, you can overwatch it and get a good overwatch. Or if they beam it over to you and you still have some shooting left, the shooting you put into it is actually good or effective, same as the melee, it's actually good or effective. You give up having, you know, more offense in the Oath of Moment stuff, but the psychological weight that has now left your mind because they're less likely to use the Yin Khan might be worth it. Might be worth it for some people. If you've got Gilliman and you've got two O's at the moment, slapping one on the Incarn all game doesn't cost you that much. Probably a great call.
Just on the off chance you get to put some damage on him?
No, it's giving them the same deterrent they've given you. They've given you a big psychological issue to deal with, and now you're giving. They're gonna have to pay the piper if they actually want to use it now. They'd be like, well, you can still use it, but I'm gonna kill it so much easier. It's not gonna be as effective, you know, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, no, fair enough. Being on Yin card management, I think is a big deal. And for Space Marines or anything, Oath of the Moment is such a powerful tool, and maybe you do give them a deterrent. I don't know that they would not bring it over there as a momentum shift.
Yeah, exactly right. Once again, like I said, staging and like making sure you have a plan of which units you want to remove from your opponent's army in which order, so you de-incentivize them to spawn the Incarn is also a great idea as well.
Oh yeah, I love that idea too. Is like what do you offer up to them as targets for the Eldari if you are in a position where you have to offer up anything?
Yeah, so if you have a unit in the open, close to your lines that is of your opponents, kill that with the worst guns you can, so your best guns are still there if they want to put the Yin Khan there. I guess it would be the idea. Like, you know, you're playing guard, you line up your demolishers to shoot that unit. And then you kill it with like a basilisk or a manticore and be like, well, you can put the Incarn there, but I'm going to blow it up if you do. Those kind of things. Set traps for it. It may mean you're making an overcommitment to this unit, to stopping this unit doing what it's doing, but yeah, that's just kind of the game it forces you to play.
Yeah, and I do like also that you can say you're playing like a big heavy list, like the strikes on this. The melee profile, you know, because the idea is that it teleports over there and gets a charge in and can get into something brutal. But it's only 5 attacks on the heavy strength one. It's only strength 12. So there are things that I can actually stand up to the strength 12.
Yeah, absolutely. So
once the neg 4 REP gets in there, it's a different situation.
Well, it doesn't have that many attacks in combat. Yeah, it's only five quality attacks. So if you have just a 4-up invuln in combat, in melee, like it's actually kind of unlikely to kill you because it's not going to put 5 wounds on you, and then you can 50-50, and then it's just kind of how high does it roll in the D6s?
Yeah, and then if you go the other way, the 10 attacks, it is neg 4 AP, but it's only 1 damage when it gets through for the sweep attacks. But I think the real reason this is in such as many lists, i.e. almost every single Eldari list you're going to see past round 3, is the ability to jump. And
exactly right.
It's huge. It's a momentum shift. Like, you know, we talk about how to get the momentum, to score points, to be on objectives, to take away some of the game from your opponent. Like, any time that you can start making your opponent react to what you're doing, then you're better off than you were before. And the Incarn forces that with no exception.
Agreed.
Which is a cool piece. Like, I like that exists, but it is something that, because it has this unique rule, it can catch a lot of people by surprise, I think.
It really can. And it's one of those things that gets better the later the game goes. Of course, you know, Eldar has a lot of quality anti-tank. And if you remove just one or two pieces of anti-Yin Khan, you know, killing units, you just spawn the thing judiciously and your opponent can't really do anything about it. It's just going to run roughshod. The best thing you can do, though, in that situation is just walk away from the thing and try not to give it a better option to spawn later.
Yeah, good point. Yeah, or kill it. I guess you got to make that value assessment. Like, how much of your army do you have to devote to taking this thing down?
Yeah, exactly right.
Be prepared out there. You were definitely going to see the Incarn in tournament list, but rightly so. It's awesome. I kind of hate it that it outshines the Avatar Arcane, just sheer brutality of stats right now. Because the Avatar Arcane has great stats. Remember, there are no bad units in the Eldari Index.
And I gotta say, it kind of bugs me that this, like, spindly, Eldari-looking, swirly, mostly hair unit is toughness 10, but I get it.
But it is. It's the Avatar of the...
I get
Eldari
it.
Eldari God of Death. You know, come on.
I know.
It's awesome.
I mean, it's kind of weird that it's, like, as tough as just, like, some dude on a dinosaur in orbs.
That is funny.
Oh man, that.
We now have a toughness stat for dinosaurs. So just for the people out there wondering if they could. Yeah.
The metric in which we'll all judge future dinosaurs.
T10 or don't even come at me.
Yeah.
Well, it's changing gears a bit. I'm basically taking a turn here trying to paint a Tyranid.
And yeah.
I have figured out, or at least I in the very beginning, I had no idea what I was doing.
Sure you did. You just didn't think you knew.
That's the way it felt. Actually, I got a little bit comfortable about midway through the paint job. I'm like, this is not looking as bad as I thought it was going to look. That's as good as I got right now. But then it's like with miniature painting, you know, you just kind of like work through the ugly phases. You know,
Just keep putting more paint on it till it looks good.
That's right. But you know that when you start filling in the blocks, you start painting in the blocks, things start to look a little bit better. But I had not. No, I'm trying to paint like a Leviathan type color scheme. My buddy, I told you, who's he's revved up about Ultramarines, and I'm certainly going to help him try to get that army on the table and everything. But I thought, like, what better to like after we got this army on the table to like ruin it is to eat it with a bunch of Tyranids that there's four bodies. So yeah, this is a little insight into how the brain works here, you know. So why not paint some of the Tyranids that came in the starter set?
So you actually went into the group chat and you were like, I'm gonna try painting some Tyranids, and I was like, my advice to you was, well, it wasn't really advice, it was just like my observation was that you actually don't have to paint them as good. Like, you have to paint them good, but like it's kind of a little bit more forgiving because it's like it's an organic creature, so it's not going to be like perfectly symmetrical, right? Like the colors aren't going to be like perfectly delineated.
I love that advice, because it's about, you know, setting your own expectations, you know, and then of course, you know, not letting comparison get in the way of your enjoyment of it. Paint your own standards and go for it.
That's right. And yeah, so I actually really enjoy Tyranids. I don't think that I would really enjoy playing them, but, you know, having a buddy that, you know, plays Tyranids really well and does not quite enjoy painting them, it's a good you know, it's a good understanding that we have. You know, I just call him up, be like, you got any bugs? And he'll be like, yeah, here you go.
I don't know that I went, like, I've got my paint job is Leviathan-ish. And I say ish because I primed them with gray sear and then dry brushed everything white. And I used a very, very thin down Vulpus pink to do all like the undercarriage type stuff of them. And then went in with less diluted Vulpus pink in the joints. And I don't have Leviathan purple contrast, or I probably would have tried that. Although I get nervous using contrast on what is like whatever the top coat, you know, like what would be the exoskeleton type stuff.
Sure. Like the parts that everybody's going to look at.
Yeah. I would get nervous using contrast on that. So I went with, what is it? It's like, it's not Xerxes purple. It's the darker purple of the layer paint. No, there's no Roth in it. I can find it.
Right, there's not.
Might as well jump for this paint. It's so purple. But there isn't that. It's the one that starts with an X. And then I tried to get real fancy with it, and instead of shading it with Nolan oil, I shaded it with Basilicum Gray, a very thin down Basilicum Gray.
Ooh, how did that go?
I liked it. It started coming together. So I painted all the undercarriage. You know, I'm saying the undercarriage. You don't talk about like the lighter parts on the Tyranid Leviathan color scheme with a lot of Vulpus pink, and then went back and did a light, you know, dry brush, not overly dry, like it doesn't look fuzzy at all, like a real, real light dry brush of white, and did a little bit of spot whiting just like on the very, where the tops of the bones look like they would meet and that kind of stuff. And I painted just the bottom half of it, hooves and all, painted the bottom half. And the hooves, I struggle with the hooves because sometimes you see that, you know, they got black. I went with like the brownish red, orangish type hooves and claws. And this, I don't know if I did a great job on it yet, but I am at least happy with the way the result looks. And I did that with going with Rhinox hide and then a little bit of layer of Doombull brown and then Basilicum gray light over that, under that. And then I forget the... This is a terrible tutorial. Not one of the new browns that looks like an orange. as the final coat.
I only have the old ones. I can't help you out.
I will put these colors in the show notes, but it got me something that I'm pretty happy with.
Are you going to send me a picture so I can put it up on our socials?
I will eventually send pictures. Yes.
Okay.
I gotta look at this model for a while before I get right. Before I get super happy with it. But I tried something new. I've never painted this scheme before, and I looked at a bunch of tutorials, and I found a tutorial, like a mixture of a couple tutorials that I felt was good for me. And then when I got stuck on the hooves, I reached out to a painter that I know and said, I know you've painted this scheme before. How would you do it again, kind of thing? And how would you do it? Yeah. They said, yep, and suggested a couple things. I did not have the exact color that they suggested, but I had one very similar, and I'm happy with the result. So I've taken now that brown, that dark brown going up to orangish is what I went for the claws as well. So I feel like I'm on the right track. And then as I got more of the model blocked in, like with the purple armor, then shading the armor, and then putting those, you know, little striation line highlights on the armor, as it all started to come together, I started to feel good. And then I put yellow eyes on the Tyranid. And do you know that the weapons, the guns of Tyranids also have eyes?
Do they?
They have eyes. A lot of creepy stuff with the Tyranids.
Targeting cool. systems. I dig it.
And the ammunition is typically like some kind of bugs or grubs that they fire out.
But, gross.
A lot of creepy stuff with the Tyranids. But yeah, their guns have eyes. So once I started filling in all these little details, and then you could start to see the differences in the color, like what I think what my stumbling block was when I had that the Under Armour part, you know, the bones and stuff started to paint it out, it just looked a little washed out and didn't, you know, as you start to fill in the colors, it starts to take some shape, you get to kind of see the vision start to form, and I got through it. But it was a whole thing. It was looking at tutorials, you know, overcoming that anxiety of starting something new, phoning several friends, you know, sanity checks along the way, and then, you know, falling back on some kind of like tried and true methods of just sticking with it, fighting through those, and I'm using air quotes here, the ugly stages of the model until you get to something that you're comfortable with.
Yeah.
You know what I really love? So now that we have Patreon, we have a Patreon Discord, and I love that we can like interact with people when they have sort of like doubts or questions about their painting as well. So I would suggest you, Paul, to like also use that as a resource when you have painting questions.
That is a great suggestion, and should definitely do that. We should throw more pictures in there. We actually did a like a hobby hangout at least once also in there. I was building models, I think, getting ready for the ATC.
Yeah, those are always fun.
Yeah. Well, I just want to talk about it. I wanted to share like a personal story about, you know, going into a completely new model line that I don't recall ever painting a Tyranid in the past. It has
to happen. Do you know what like my go-to is when I'm feeling like a little bit down on my painting, or like I'm not sure where to go next on a model? Do you know what I do?
I'm listening.
I turn on The Joy of Painting.
All right.
With Bob Ross.
Yeah, with Bob Ross. Yep. Yeah.
And Bob Ross talks me through it, you know? Yep. And he reinforces to me that it's my painting and I can't make mistakes and it's just paint. So if I don't like it, I just paint over it again.
Wonderful.
Yeah, it makes me feel so much better.
Well, we can't top that. So that's our show this week. We can't top that legend.
He is a legend.
It's been awesome hanging out. We're misread. He'll be back on the next show. And yeah, that's it. Incarn is a menace. But it is manageable. Astra Militarum got some depth in that codex. Just kind of get picky and choosy. But I kind of suggest that to anyone that is struggling out there right now. Maybe look to step outside of the comfort zone of units that you are used to taking, and you might have to take things that you have to take to do things. And I loved your Adam, what you were talking about with the maybe choosing to go with a objective set, even if it's a fixed objectives that may score you less points, but it doesn't put you into a pressure luck
dangerous
or diminishing return type of scenario.
Exactly right. You don't compromise your ability to play the game into the later turns of the game because you have no army left.
I'm digging that. Thanks to everybody who's tuned in. Please leave us those 5-star reviews. We haven't asked for those in a little bit, but it's one of the hassle-free ways that you can actually show the show some support, and it also helps other people find the show. Leave some comments when you see this on the YouTube channel, if you watch it there. maybe consider checking us out on Patreon. You know, it helps everything go around. I've enjoyed talking to y'all this week, and we'll see y'all next week.
See you then.
Bye, everybody.
What they said, but I already subscribed. You better do it too.